Yeah, we might as well shut off the lights. We won't leave them off the whole time. So basically what I'll do is give you about a 30-minute presentation. And then after that, we'll just open the floor for whatever kind of questions you want to ask. The last time we did one of these in Riley, I think I just introduced myself and then I answered questions for 2 hours. So that was one of the better meetings I've ever done. I really enjoyed it. But basically, my job is to help people who are having problems with wildlife in Kansas. It ranges anywhere from mice and rats to bats, snakes, prairie dogs, gophers, moles, all that kind of stuff, all the way up to livestock losses. And Lindsay kind of asked me to focus on livestock losses for this presentation, so that's what we'll do. But any questions you have, whether it's about wildlife enhancement, so managing for more deer, wildlife disease stuff, I know that's a pretty big topic right now, or anything, feel free to bring them up once we get into the question and answer part. I usually title these, people a lot of times will ask me to do a predator control program. But there's sort of this connotation, and it's a misunderstanding that predator control just means we're going to go kill stuff. Predator control is really thinking holistically about controlling predation. So there's a lot of non-lethal stuff that we do along with the lethal control options as well. So really a better way with the way we use words today seems to be managing predation rather than predator control. So just kind of a quick outline of the different things that you should expect me to talk about during the next 30 minutes or so. We'll hit some livestock predation statistics, and then we'll talk about how to do a mortality investigation. If you're a livestock producer and you go out in the pasture and you find a dead sheep or a dead cow, how do you figure out what happened to it? Some of you are probably might be a veterinarian, or maybe in a past life you're a veterinarian, and so that's an easy thing for you to do. But for a lot of people, that's not necessarily an easy thing to do. So we'll talk about that, then we'll talk about preventing predation, and then we'll sort of finish up with our lethal control options for here in Kansas, and we won't talk about elsewhere too much. First, though, I always like to bring this in. When we're thinking about managing wildlife damage, this acronym, H-E-R, is really a good way to remember the practical solutions to wildlife damage. So I teach a semester-long class every spring at K-State on wildlife damage management. And about half the stuff, half the methods that work in real life aren't practical in real life. If you're losing sheep to coyotes, we can go out there and catch the resident coyotes that occupy that territory and spay and neuter that pair and turn them back out there after they've healed up, and you probably won't lose any more sheep. Is that a practical option? No, it's not practical, even though it works. Now, from a research standpoint, that helps us understand why predation occurs, and so it's still a valuable thing that those scientists figured out, but it's not a practical solution. So H in that acronym stands for habitat modification. So we're getting rid of the food, cover, and water that's attracting a critter to a spot where it's causing problems for you. And this is a drastic example, but is there any reason for a bunny rabbit to be out here? No, there's no cover for a cottontail out there. He's going to get killed by a hawk. There's no food, and there's no water out there. So we shouldn't expect to see any rabbit damage in the middle of that field. We'll talk about what habitat modification means from a predator exclusion standpoint in a bit. E is exclusion. Typically, when we're talking about exclusion, we're talking about some form of a repellent or a fence. And a lot of times in garden sorts of situations, small ruminants, so if we got sheep and goats, we can do a good job of fencing predators out. It's pretty tough to fence predators out of an entire cattle pasture, but it is an option that can work pretty well. A more practical repellent, if we're thinking about excluding predators from a cattle operation, might be guardian animals. So that would be a method to exclude coyotes that is not something that we necessarily think about it as exclusion, but it is. And then removal. So
and removal can be dead or alive. Society has this sort of misunderstanding these days that it's more humane to trap a critter and take it somewhere else than it is to euthanize it. And I don't have time to tell you all the reasons why that doesn't work out in reality most of the time. But if you want to learn more about it, there's a podcast episode on our Fence, Fur, and Feather podcast out of K-State where we cover all those different reasons. But don't be trapping critters and moving them most of the time. If you need to remove a critter, lethal control is going to be the best way. Now, not all critters are legal to remove. What do you do if you got a deer problem? Can you go out there and shoot those deer and leave them lay because they're eating your crops? No, because we have a specific statute that covers big game that's separate from the statute that allows us to do that with other critters like raccoons, let's say. So if we need to remove deer, then you first need to try and do that through regulated hunting. And if regulated hunting didn't alleviate your problem, and there's damage on your property and there's evidence of deer, then Wildlife and Parks will issue you big game control permits that will allow you to take those deer outside of the regular season. So there's an additional step for that removal. You can't just go out there and shoot them critters and leave them lay like we can some others. All right, so those statistics I was telling you about. This is from the National Ag Statistics Service. It's a branch of USDA. Many of you, if you're agricultural producers, may have been surveyed by USDA. If you get contacted by USDA for one of those surveys, I urge you to answer the questions because it helps me, and it helps me teach people. Because without those surveys, we don't have any of this kind of data. So if we're looking at predator-related loss, so percentage of any losses that's actually due to predation, you in the U.S., 33% of sheep losses each year on average are due to a predator. In Kansas, it's 13. 40% of lamb losses in the U.S. on average are due to predators. 24% in Kansas. 2.4% of cattle losses are due to a predator. In Kansas, it's 0.2%. 11% of calf losses in the U.S. are due to predators, and it's just under 5% in Kansas. So, for the most part, we do a lot better than the national average on losses related to predators that in our livestock. And there may be a lot of different reasons for that. One of them may be because we don't have a whole lot of large predators. But there are some states that have predator communities that are fairly similar to ours that report much higher numbers. So our system in Kansas seems to work pretty well. And it's kind of interesting because our system's different from a lot of states. We don't have federal predator control in Kansas. Our legislators decided that they didn't want to have that federal oversight in our state. They didn't want to pay taxes and then also have producers be cost sharing on top of that to have the feds come in and do this. And so they created the Wildlife Damage Control branch of Kansas State University, which is now one person, me, and it has been for a long time, to teach people how to take care of their own problems and also connect people with folks who hunt coyotes and folks who trap and those sorts of things. And it works pretty good. So if we think about the different critters that are responsible for that livestock predation, 47% of sheep losses that are due to predators, so 47% of 33% in the U.S. is coyotes, 72% of predator-associated losses in Kansas of sheep are coyotes. Did somebody have a question? No? Okay. U.S. lamb losses, 59% of losses due to predators, 46% of lamb losses in Kansas that are due to predators are by coyotes. 40% of cattle losses that are due to predators in the U.S., 68% of the cattle losses that are due to predators in Kansas are due to coyotes, and 84% of calf losses. What do you think the next line is going to be? What's the next most common predator of our livestock? Bobcats?
Good to guess.
No? Good thought.
Wolves?
Well, do we have many wolves in Kansas? No. Okay, so no. What else?
Coyote?
That's what we got here. The next one's actually...
Birds? I mean, like eagles or hawks or anything along that line?
No. The next one's actually got a home most of the time.
No dogs.
I wouldn't put the feral in front of dogs. I would just say dogs because a lot of the dog issues that I go help with turn out to be a neighbor dog. Sometimes they belong to the person who's having the losses, which is a big challenge as well. But a fairly large percentage relative to what most people would expect of those losses are due to dogs. What about mountain lions? I know this is a big topic. One of the things that I hope this really reinforces is that even in states with large populations of mountain lions, for mountain lions, right? Mountain lions are big enough and they occupy big enough territories that they're never going to be as abundant on the landscape as something like a coyote is. But for states that have a lot of mountain lions, relatively speaking, mountain lions really don't fool with livestock all that much. They're wary. They don't want to be around people. They're also very, very, very efficient predators. They kill enough deer and small game that they don't really have to fool with the livestock that we care about and are checking on a regular basis. I have a buddy who cut his teeth in ranching while he was going to tech school in Wyoming, and they took all their cattle up in the mountains to graze during the summertime, turned them all loose, checked on them maybe once every couple of weeks, and then went up there and gathered them up and brought them back down to the low country during the wintertime. They didn't lose a lot of cattle or calves to mountain lions. It's just not something that those mountain lions do all that regularly. So 5% or less for all these critters for thinking about losses associated with mountain lions. And then in Kansas, in the year that these data are from, it was reported 7% of calf losses that were due to predators were due to mountain lions. Something that's important to know is that there's not been a confirmed predation event on livestock by mountain lions in Kansas since the last historic lion was killed in 1905. And what I mean by confirmed is myself, my predecessor, his predecessor going back to the 70s, or any of the fur bearer biologists during that time have never received evidence that even remotely looked like a lion kill. And we investigate these things all the time. I was in Leavenworth last night looking at goats that had been killed to determine what killed them. And almost always, if somebody thinks it's mountain lions, it's because how gruesome it was. And almost always, when it's that gruesome, it's dogs rather than mountain lions. Mountain lions are really efficient. And they kill things quickly and then feed in very specific ways. So that's there, but I guarantee you that 7% of those calves that year did not die due to mountain lions. The new kid on the block is the black vulture. When these data were reported, I think 2016, 2015, something like that, there hadn't been any reported by producers losses of any of these critters due to black vultures, but we have had a few recently. The thing to know about vultures is Missouri's really excited about them, Oklahoma's really excited about them, and so if you're listening to the radio, you may be hearing, come get your black vulture permits so that you can kill the black vultures when they attack your cattle. The first thing to know about that is that there's a very, very small area of Kansas where there's black vultures. If you're north of Oklahoma to Highway 400 and really west of Highway 69, then you're probably not going to ever see a black vulture in Kansas, at least right now. They may expand, beyond that at some point, but that's about the limit of their range within the state. And if you get sort of payola, then you're too far north. There were lots of reports of them in the Flint Hills this year. All of those that I got pictures of and that I went out and looked at, they were turkey vultures. And here in a little bit, I'll show you how to tell the difference between a turkey vulture and a black vulture. And the big challenge is that young turkey vultures can have dark heads that make them look black. The other thing about this is that even in places where they have a lot of black vultures all the time, they don't kill very much livestock. They scavenge a lot, just like turkey vultures do, and every once in a while they'll get aggressive enough that they kill a calf or a lamb or a goat kid. They're kind of the boogeyman right now. And they're the same sort of boogeyman that mountain lions are. And anytime we get a new kid on the block, a new predator that we're not used to dealing with, it's normal for that sort of thing to happen. So if you think you're seeing black vultures, if you think you got a mountain lion problem, reach out. Part of my job is to come help you. And I'm very glad to do that. So I don't want to try and minimize any of this stuff. This was a $126,000 burden on Kansas goat producers, and that would have been based on the 2014 goat numbers or goat market. $625,000 burden to Kansas sheep producers. That would have been based on 2019 data. And based on 2015 data, that was a $4 million burden to Kansas cattle producers. If we adjust that for inflation and current cattle market prices, it's what, 2 to 3 times that amount. So this is a big burden on folks, and we need to be able to deal with it. I think one of the important things to remember is that, especially when we're thinking about cattle, you know, predator losses are a very, very small percentage of all losses. So 2.4% of cattle, which shows up right here, and then 11% of calves, which shows up right here. So it's still a small percentage. If you're a small ruminant producer, though, it's a much bigger percent. So 33% for sheep is bigger than any other source of mortality, and 40% for lambs is almost twice the other sources of mortality. So it is very important. All right, so what about mountain lions? I know that we've had some confirmations up this way, and especially during 2024, there were a whole bunch, and most of those were on the east side of Tuttle. But this is where we're at as far as confirmations of mountain lions in Kansas since the first modern lion was detected in 2007. So 127 detections. And the important part about this is that's not 127 cats. It's, you know, in 2023, there was a cat that most likely was the same cat. At one time, there were, I think, 3 in the state at the same time, if I remember correctly. And that we knew because there were trail cameras that hit in 3 different places that were far enough apart that it couldn't have been the same line within a short time period. One of those individuals moved down sort of through the Flint Hills, ended up in the Neosho River drainage, got detected around Iola, then Parsons, then Edna, and then it was gone. And that's typically what happens with these lions. They're young males that are dispersing from populations that are producing a surplus. What happens to a male lion if it stays in its natal home range where it was born?
It's killed.
It gets killed. Yeah, adult male lions don't tolerate young male lions staying around after they're a year or two old. They kill them. And so they have to go find a new home somewhere. And as those individuals disperse, they're looking for good habitat and they're looking for a female. They find good habitat here, but they keep moving because they don't find a female. So 127, I don't know how many cats that is, but I would be very surprised if any of these years had many more than five or six cats included in them. Most of these 40 detections were by one individual mountain lion during that year. That mountain lion is no longer with us, and that's, I can't really say anything else about it because there's an ongoing investigation / legal issue with that. But the lion that caused most of those 40 detections is not around anymore. What these detections are is where there was photographic evidence, a track, the actual animal, or hair that could have been submitted for a DNA sample, and so it was actually a confirmed cat. There's been one female confirmed when we can actually see the parts and pieces of that critter that we need to be able to tell what it is. None of those were confirmed from pictures, that one wasn't confirmed from a picture. It was a female that died in a shed in Dodge City because it was doing so poorly. It starved to death. So I get lots of reports of, I saw a female with cubs. None of those have ever been substantiated, and with the number of trail cameras that there are on the landscape, if there's a female with cubs, we ought to have pictures of them. This last year, Oklahoma documented reproduction for the first time in two counties adjacent to Kansas. So it's likely that at some point in the sometime not too distant future that we will have reproduction by mountain lions in Kansas. But if we have, it hasn't been documented and they haven't stayed put because we tend to know if there's one around. So that's my mountain lion spiel. Okay, you go out to pasture and you find this. What happened? What do we need to do to figure out what happened? What's the first thing your eyes are drawn to when you look at that carcass?
Well, Kyle, take the back side out.
Something chewed on it, right? It's been fed on. Okay, that's my response. That's the normal response when we see a picture like this or walk up on that sort of scenario. But just because it's been fed on does not mean that that's what killed it, right? And so that's what we got to figure out. We got to figure out what the cause of death is. And remember, there's lots and lots of different reasons critters die. What happened to that sheep? Any sign of predation? Is it fed on? Blood? No?
Hey, how much blood is around there? How much blood is inside the carcass? Almost none, right? Okay. How much blood's on the grass? Almost none. Look at its feet. That's a brand new baby calf that hadn't stood up yet. Those yellow membranes scar up and wear off real fast, right? That was a stillborn calf. The assumption was that it was attacked and killed by a mountain lion. And it had to be a mountain lion because they fed on the guts first. That is one of the things that if you search on the internet, you will find. They open the abdomen first and they eat the organs first. Problem is, this calf didn't have any developed guts yet anyway. So they weren't there, not well developed enough that something like a mountain lion would pull them out. Coyotes and dogs will open the abdomen. They open lots of different areas, and so we see some strange feeding behavior sometimes. Go back to this one. What happened to this 500-pound bull? So if we ignore this part back here, what do we see here? It's got a respiratory infection. We got foam coming out of its lungs. That's not a good thing. So I went down there. They thought it was a mountain lion. They wanted to get compensation from USDA for a predator loss. So I went down there and skinned it out, found no evidence of a predator kill. We did find a very inflamed trachea. And rather than an inflamed trachea, what I was looking for is this. When a predator attacks and the heart is still beating, we get subdermal hematomas. which is bleeding below the skin from those ruptured blood vessels, okay? This is what a veterinarian would call a honker. Went from pasture to feed, and in that process of going from pasture to feed, got an inflamed trachea, got an infection, and died as a result of that. This picture, before we leave this one though, we can see what fed on it, and what fed on it wasn't a mountain lion. Those are coyote tracks there. So even if we don't have a wet area, sometimes the blood that comes out of a carcass will give us the opportunity to find tracks and that sort of thing. This is one I got called on a Friday afternoon about 4 o'clock and made a trip to Atchison because producer found a cow about noon after checking cattle the previous day and everything was fine. Cow's face was fed on, throat was eaten out. He did an internet search that said it was a mountain lion. Okay. So I got there, he was actually at the diner eating supper, so I went ahead and got started. And as I started skinning right here, that's what I found. What's that? Should a cow that's been dead in 40 degree weather for less than 24 hours have that color inside of it on its neck? No, that's blackleg. So what happened there was he had bought a cow at the sale barn. Everything else was vaccinated. She didn't get vaccinated yet because he had just bought her. I see a lot of cattle that have the feeding on their face and that sort of thing because it's not what people are used to seeing from coyotes. I think a lot of times coyotes start chewing where it smells the worst. And I think sometimes that's associated with these weird infections or a nasty smell coming out of the mouth or something like that. So what do we have going on here? This is really the most common thing that we would see. Maybe a calf that's been chewed on from the back end. What doesn't look right about these pictures? Where's the blood? None. None on the ground. There wasn't any in the vicinity. One of the things I see a lot on calves like this, see how wet the fur is? And it's combed almost? That's mama licking him. She cleaned him off. She tried to get him to get up. Maybe he got up, fell back down. But this was a calf that died of natural causes. This one is a little more iffy. See how bright red that meat is and how there's blood on the hide around it? This is one where I got sent pictures, but I never got to go see the site. We would expect, in this case, for there to be blood on the surrounding grass and that sort of thing. This is one that was possibly killed by coyotes. I don't know for sure, but that really bright red flesh, the blood on the hair around it, if that calf was dead when the coyotes got to it, it hadn't been dead very long. Versus this one that, I mean, we got pink meat, no blood, nothing. This one, sometimes we get sent pictures like this. Then we go investigate, well, this situation here, this is what we found in the crop field where the cattle actually were, next to the fenced off area where that hide was found. Okay, so this is the kind of blood we're looking for when we've actually got a predation event. I had a sheep producer call me one time and he said, I went out to check sheep this morning. There was a ewe in the pen and it looked like somebody had taken red magic marker and strung it all over her side. And then I realized that that's not what it was. So I went to try and find her lamb. The lamb had been killed in the night. Okay, blood under pressure sprays, right? So that's the kind of blood we're talking about. Okay, coyote predation. Coyotes, whether we're talking about calves, sheep, goats, their normal attack area is going to be the throat, the cheeks, sometimes the back of the neck. It's very, very common for them to work together. So you might have one member of the family group that's got a hold of the throat, another one that's got a hold of a back leg, and they're stretching them out. So almost all of the time, if a coyote, a wolf, or a mountain lion kills something, they're going to kill it by attacking the throat or the back of the neck or even crushing the back of the head. They'll feed starting from the back end fairly often, especially if we're talking about coyotes or wolves, but they kill up here. And so that's why when I go investigate one of these, I skin out the head and neck. Okay, we're looking for that attack area. Here's a sheep at the K-State Sheep Unit, a pretty big ewe lamb that got attacked by a coyote and lived through it. So we see that big, big swelling or the edema, and also the hemorrhaging down below her neck. She ended up living. The vet school told them that it had to be dogs because if it was a coyote, it would have killed them. Well, coyotes they're not always successful. And an interesting thing about this one, when we set the traps and caught the coyote, I caught one that had a great big old abscess on his jaw on the side. And I think he was real hungry. He was attacking probably bigger lambs than he could handle. And he wasn't an efficient predator because of that issue that he had associated with his jaw as well. So we got rid of him and we quit having problems. One of the challenges with coyote predation is if you don't have any other sign, it can be hard to tell the difference between what coyotes do and what dogs do. A lone coyote, especially on a bigger calf, might try and get a hold of them by the face like this, chew up their nose, chew up the front end of their head, and be unsuccessful. Or they may get a hold of a calf from the back end and chew their tail off or chew their back end up, but they can't ever get up there and get a hold of their head and get them killed. So that can happen. But sometimes we'll see that attack focused on the hind quarter with the tail removed, and sometimes the front end. And to rule out dog here, we need tracks and scat and that sort of stuff. Fairly often, I'll get pictures sent to me of attacks focused on the back legs, hind quarters like this, where sometimes we end up like this one. Those wounds weren't lethal, right? That steer was run and bitten until it died, run to exhaustion. That's a hallmark of dog predation. Mountain lions, they're not going to attack their back legs. They don't jump on their back and do this kind of stuff and create those big old scratches like sometimes people think they do. They're pretty efficient. It's not uncommon to see pretty bad face mutilation like this. Might chew the face entirely off of a sheep or something without killing it. Unfortunately, we get a fair number of bottle calves that get their back straps chewed off of them and they'll still be alive. And German shepherds seem to like to do this sometimes. It's an unfortunate deal. And I think one of the things that really surprises people is a dog that is a loving family dog has a switch in it that'll flip every once in a while. They'll get to playing, they'll get to roughhousing, who knows what happened, and then all of a sudden something flips. And they do something that's way out of character for that dog. But that's a challenge that we do have to deal with sometimes. One of the things that's really clear here is there's almost no feeding, and the feeding occurred before the critter was dead. Again, almost no feeding, none at all here. Just chewing on the face here, but critter's still alive. This was a situation down by Council Grove that we had a couple of years ago. I think by the time we got the issue figured out, by the time they got connected to me, they had lost something like 14 mamas. They thought they had a mountain lion running around that was running their cattle. Typically, if cattle are being run, whether it's through fences or run to exhaustion like this, it's dogs. Mountain lions catch stuff and kill it. They're good at what they do. Coyotes wouldn't fool with anything this big. But this was a challenging situation because it's the brother-in-law's dog. And the dog wasn't attacking his cattle, but it was coming over to their place and attacking theirs. So That was one of those crazy deals. But I mean, this is like a 1,200-pound cow that they got pinned down in a little old ditch and just wore her out. running them into the pond and stuff. In that situation, there were quite a few cattle that were still healthy that had their ears chewed off. That's another thing. Wild predators don't just chew the ears off of live cattle. That's just not, it doesn't even make sense. They go to kill stuff. But dogs were the problem there. One of the things that's important is if you're going to take pictures and send them to somebody, make sure there's something in there for scale. That's not a small pocket knife. That pocket knife's about that long. But I know how big that pocket knife is, and so it's a good reference. Doesn't matter if it's a phone, a pack of cigarettes, your hat, whatever you've got that's of known size, stick it in there. A lot of times I get shown pictures like this that this is evidence of claw marks. Those are not claw marks. Those are drag marks from incisors. Those are blunt incisors that are being raked over that. This is the belly of a goat trying to open that goat up. If this was mountain lion claws, those wounds would be about a half inch deep and flailed open about an inch wide. Mountain lion claws are sharp. Think about what a cat does to your skin, a house cat. Okay, how big is that house cat? 5 pounds? A young mountain lion that's dispersing is about 80. A big adult lion that's going to be a resident is going to be 150, 160 pounds, right? Think about those claws and what those would do. Something that livestock guardian dogs tend to do sometimes is they'll start licking on a sheep and all of a sudden the hide starts pulling off when they're licking on it, and then that gets kind of tasty and we might end up with a window chewed in the side of this sheep. That's guard dog stuff, unfortunately. We've got sheep that their back ends are mutilated, no feeding done. Predators attack livestock because they're hungry, not because they want to chew on them. This is just chewing on them. That's just mutilation. This one was not too far from here, I don't think. Up around Clay Center, neighbor's Pyrenees dogs got into the pig pen, and this is what happens when a Pyrenees bites into a small piglet, right? It looks like this. It's actually this from those canine teeth. This was one that was sent to me. The veterinarian confirmed that a mountain lion attacked this golden retriever and did this. I can't say for sure what dog did this, but this golden retriever was still alive. If this had been a mountain lion attack, number one, the golden retriever would be dead. Number two, it wouldn't have attacked its armpit. It would have crushed the back of its skull, gotten a hold of it by the throat. But I think that they had just a dog fight in the yard, because there were the other dogs that were there were dog breeds that can become aggressive and were plenty big enough to attack that golden retriever and killed it. But really ragged wounds, not clean cuts, grabbing and shaking, victim survives. So one of the challenges I have sometimes is talking to a producer or a dog owner and telling them, no, your veterinarian was wrong and here's why, without saying that the veterinarian didn't know what they were talking about. One of the big challenges we have is that most of our veterinarians in Kansas have never had any training on how to identify a predator attack. They started asking me to come to the vet conference a couple years ago, and I hope they have me come back every couple of years so I can keep showing them these kind of pictures and training them. Mountain lion predation, here's a horse. Horses are rarely attacked by wildlife. Anybody know why? Predators do not like to attack critters that can kill them. Right? That's why predators rarely attack other predators. But this horse was bitten by a mountain lion and killed. We can see those four canine marks grabbing a hold of the throat, puncturing it very efficiently. And if we were to open that up, it would look like this mule deer's neck on the inside. Right? We would see massive trauma in there. One of the things that mountain lions do that we look for when we investigate these sorts of things is pluck hair off of their prey prior to consuming them. Raccoons are a really common prey item for mountain lions, which a lot of people don't know. But we of the trail camera pictures that have been submitted to Wildlife and Parks and some of those shared with me, of mountain lions in our state in the last few years, it's surprising how many of those mountain lions are at a deer feeder with a coon in their mouth. It's a prey item that they go after fairly regularly. But this is a raccoon that's been plucked before it was eaten and then cast. Here's a deer, and you can see all this loose hair around. Anybody ever watch a nature show and see a cat starting to eat a prey item, and they take a bite of the hair, and then they're doing this stuff trying to get it out of their mouth? That's a normal thing that they almost always do before they open that critter up. Another thing that they do when they leave stuff behind is cache their prey. They cover it up with whatever loose vegetation or other debris might be around. So there's a deer underneath that pile of grass. There's corn stalks over the top of a deer. Even if it doesn't seem like there ought to be anything for them to cover it up with, this mountain lion has still tried to cache that elk out in the middle of that hay meadow. This was one in Missouri, a fairly young mountain lion that successfully captured an elk. One of the important things to see here is, I think this was a big enough prey that it probably didn't know exactly what to do at first, but they almost always, on a larger prey item, will open the abdomen up first. And they pull the guts out, and they eat the fleshy organs first. So they'll pull the guts out, they'll eat the heart, the lungs, and the liver, and leave behind the parts of the rumen and the intestines. So that's another thing that we're looking for when we have a livestock loss. These are pictures that were sent to me that people thought the horse had been attacked by a mountain lion. And I never did get this gal convinced that she had something out in her pasture, like maybe a fence, that could have done that to her horse. But that's what it was. Unfortunately, I can't make everybody right. But again, that's a fence post, right? We see a lot of that sort of stuff with horses. What might have caused that? That's what we're looking for with black vulture predation or eagle predation. Pecking the eyes out. I'd show you the pictures I've got of a scoured calf that an eagle killed over by Perry this year, but you don't want to see those pictures while you're eating banana pudding pie. But pecking out the soft tissue, the eyes, the genitals, the anus, and that's how they actually kill them. And again, this is a very rare thing that we sometimes see with black vultures, almost never see with turkey vultures. That doesn't mean that it's never happened, but it's incredibly rare. So this bird on the left is a black vulture, and the bird on the right is a turkey vulture. This is an adult turkey vulture. It has a very bright red head. We see a little bit more variation in the color on its feathers, but we don't always see that. Depends on the light and that sort of thing. A white beak. A juvenile turkey vulture with a black head will still have a white beak. That black vulture has a very dark black beak. I think they're easiest to tell apart when they're way up in the air and soaring. And that's because we can look up there. And on a turkey vulture, the lighter color underneath the flight feathers starts at their body. So from their armpit all the way out to where their fingers would be on that wing, we've got light coloration all along there. And it's not maybe showing up super well just because of how much light was there, but it's obvious if you know what you're looking for. On a black vulture, it's only going to have that light coloration out on the tip. So like where your fingers or your hand would be.
I have a question for you.
Yep.
Be absolutely certain that top picture is a natural photograph, not two of them put together, meaning those two birds will be happy with eating on a carcass next to one another like that.
They will. Down in San Antonio, I see it all the time. Yep. And you'll see the black vultures come in one flock and the turkey vultures come in a different group if they're coming in together, but they'll eat at the same carcass. The black vultures are more aggressive and they'll try to run the turkey vultures off sometimes, but they'll all eat on that same carcass. But there are some rare documented occurrences of black vultures, probably where they ended up in a flock of turkey vultures and decided to migrate with them in different places. all the way up into Nebraska. But we don't have populations that stay put. And even during migration, you wouldn't expect to see black vultures here.
Those two adult photographs, meaning are those two birds the same size about as adults?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, those are adult birds. But if you think you've got black vultures, reach out. If you think you got a problem, reach out. Reach out to Lindsay. You can reach out directly to me if you can't get a hold of Lindsay. That's my job, is to help people with this kind of stuff. Okay, so how do we deal with all this? I've probably been talking too long. I'll get through the control part quick. Basically, it's an integrated approach to predator control. So we're combining non-lethal prevention strategies, which are the best thing to do long-term, that's going to help with the most problems, with removing problem critters when problems happen. So this is kind of an interesting deal here. One of the things you do to deter vultures is you put out what's called an effigy, which is a dead vulture. You can also make fake dead vultures out of stall mats. There weren't any trees in this pasture to hang one from, so he parked his combine out there and we hung the vulture effigy on the spout. So sometimes you got to get creative. So thinking about prevention strategies, we've got a lot more cattle producers, of course, than we do small ruminant producers. But even 26% of cattle producers were using guardian animals in 2015. Dogs are the most common, followed by llamas. And then, of course, we see donkeys sometimes too. You got to be careful with donkeys, though, because a good donkey will do that. A bad donkey will kill more sheep than the coyotes will. They can be really aggressive and really territorial. The nice thing about llamas and donkeys when they work is that they're compatible with my trapping methods, whereas guard dogs aren't always compatible with our lethal control methods for these different predators. Fencing, 15.5% of cattle producers in 2015 used some sort of predator control fence, which I think surprises a lot of people. But most of the cattle producers that are doing this kind of stuff are in wolf country, not coyote country, right? So if we're trying to exclude coyotes, if you're a sheep or a goat producer, woven wire is going to be best. You want the stuff with the 4x6-inch boxes. I know that this stuff with the boxes this big costs a lot less, but if you're trying to keep predators out, a coyote can squirt right through this fence. If you're using this kind of fence, the small boxes, they'll dig under in specific places. Don't fill those in. Let them dig under in those spots. Call us. I'll come out and we'll snare them coming underneath those spots, and we'll catch the ones that are causing you problems. We don't want to have to find the new spots that they make because they'll be smaller. But you can do some different things to make these fences better. I didn't mention you want them to be at least 5.5 feet high if you're trying to keep coyotes out. But if they're climbing, you can put, these are called coyote rollers, so if the pasture's behind me, you'd have a piece of fence on top of it that's going out like this. So the coyote basically has to do the limbo while he's climbing to get over the top, and he can't, right? Also, these aprons, so if we had 3 feet of fence that's coming out from this other fence, they try and dig here, it doesn't make sense to them to dig out here, and so they don't dig in. We can also use electric fence. The important thing to know if we're using electric fence is there's got to be a lot more wire than what we would normally use for sheep or cattle. And then you want to alternate your hot and ground wires so you're not relying on them to ground through the soil. And then we can have sort of modified versions of this where we've got an existing fence and we put some outriggers with hot wires coming out. We've got a barbed wire on top. Coyotes are athletes. A lot of people underestimate how much of an athlete they are, but that's why we say the fence has to be at least 5.5 feet tall, because they can jump a 4-footer pretty easy. You can build temporary electric fencing if you're trying to make sheep paddocks or something like that. The electrified poly mesh that's already in like a poultry fence works pretty good. So that's all the fencing spiel that I've got in this one. Removing dead livestock is a really, really important one. when I did my PhD research at K-State, I had GPS collars on a bunch of coyotes. So all these different colors are different colors of coyotes. And one of the things that I'd like you to notice in this picture is we've got some spots where different colors come together on the same locations on the landscape. What do you think were at those spots? That's a dead buffalo, that's a dead cow, and that's a dead pit. This is about 5 miles out of that coyote's home range. That's the boundary of Konza Prairie. This is Foot Ranch headquarters right here. That buffalo carcass there is about 1.5 or 2 miles out of the home range of that coyote right there. So they will go a long ways to a carcass. This is that same pink coyote. She had a really tight home range from April until about October, with the exception of going over here to that dead buffalo a lot. And one of the things I think people misunderstand is she doesn't just go there until the food's gone. She was going there 6 months later after there's no food left, because that was an important spot on the landscape to her, where she interacted with other coyotes, found food and all that kind of stuff. So go down to the dead pile down here every month or so, but hanging out real tight here. And then in October, she does this. If I remember right, there's like a winter lot up here that might have had a dead pile around it. And then she comes back to Konza. That was about 6 to 10 days, something like that. Goes back to this old dead buffalo carcass. Comes over here. There's a new buffalo carcass right here. And then overnight, she makes this movement. Flint Hills feeders. So there's a dead pile there, and then she got shot by the neighbor on a dead cow right here. So what's the big message in all this? Don't have vulnerable livestock around dead animals. Haul off your deads. Don't be calving where you got deads. And just to kind of drive this home even more, this is from Hugoton. There's a dead cow right there that the coyotes finished off when she was about to die giving birth. There's 13 coyotes in this image. This was 2 days after she died. Okay, you're attracting coyotes to where you don't want them to be if we got dead animals or we're calving or lambing next to a dead pit. Why is that one coyote totally black? So in this image, black is hot. We can see the faces of these other coyotes. Yeah, that's a mangy one. Suck to be that cold, wouldn't it?
I had one come in not long ago that I didn't look at at first because it was so hot.
Yeah.
It looked weird, and I actually was telling them, I'm like, I don't know what that is. Hold on a minute. We got to see.
Yeah. And you see that old spindly tail coming off of them? Yep. Also, scavenging birds like these black vultures are going to gather around carcasses. Another option might be hazing. So when we're thinking about these birds that are protected, we might have to use hazing. This picture though, if you're in an area where you've got birds like black vultures or maybe even eagles, how about we just get rid of this big dead tree that's a perch where we got calves? That was one of our solutions to the issue with the calves that were getting attacked by eagles this year over north of Topeka. I mentioned the effigies. So we tend to pair those effigies. That's one that's painted to look like a turkey vulture. But we pair the effigies with sound. The effigies don't work all that well by themselves, and firecracker type pyrotechnics don't work all that well by themselves either. But when we pair them together and we're persistent, we use them every night, we can disperse a roost in a week or two. And you'll have to, every year when the turkey vultures migrate through, you'll have to go out and do that a little bit. But we can get rid of them over short periods of time that way. Okay, so lethal control. We've got this statute that basically says if you're having property damage occur, or if you have wildlife in or near buildings that are an imminent threat, then you can kill those critters as long as you don't attempt to use them or have any attempt to use them. in your possession, and as long as they're not protected by some other law. Okay, so this applies to species that would be fur bearers like raccoons, species like coyotes that have some other regulations. It would apply to mountain lions if they were attacking your livestock. But like I mentioned earlier, it doesn't really apply to deer because we've got a separate statute that covers them. But this allows you to protect your property. If we're thinking about black vultures, there's an additional permit that has to come through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and USDA is actually who will help you do this, USDA Wildlife Services. It's not a permit to kill as many as you want to. Typically, it allows you to kill 3 to 5, and then you got to hang them as effigies and try and spook the rest of the vultures off. So that's an effigy with a live bird. Our actual mammalian predators that cause problems, targeted removal is really the approach that most places have gone to, where our goal is to remove the coyotes that are actually killing stuff. Alpha pairs that have territories are typically responsible for those losses, and coyotes with pups are the ones that are most commonly associated with those problems. It's much less expensive than trying to do population control. It's also a lower impact to non-target species, and it's also doable. The reality is we've tried to eradicate coyotes for 100 years and we haven't done it, and never will be able to do it. So it's the most common use for predator control today. A lot of people say, well, is it effective to only kill coyotes if you're having problems? And the studies that have been done on this have found no relationship between how many coyotes you kill and damage stopping. You actually have to remove those dominant coyotes that are causing the problems. In one study, one male was responsible for 71% of the kills, and didn't matter how many coyotes they killed until they got rid of him, the problem didn't stop. So selective removal of one or both of the alpha coyotes stops predation when it's occurring. So how do we do targeted removal? We trap where we're having problems. Traps work 24 hours a day. We just got to check them once a day. They're working while we're doing other stuff. Snares are the same way. They're very effective. We can also call and shoot coyotes in the areas where we're having problems. And now we've got those thermal tools that can make us very effective and open up a different time of the day as well. When we're thinking about using these tools, the important thing to remember is that the landowner or legal occupant, who would be a livestock owner or their immediate relatives, can use these tools, including thermals, lights, and night vision, outside of a normal season when losses are occurring, okay? So if you have evidence that you've lost property, a cow, a calf, and that the predator was responsible, then you would be allowed to do that outside of the season. A nuisance wildlife control operator who's licensed also could, in the case where losses were occurring. I think there's a misunderstanding that if I'm a nuisance control operator, I can use thermals to recreationally hunt outside of the season. And that's not true. If you were stopped while out hunting with thermals, let's say in July, then by the law, the game warden should ticket you, and then you would have to go to court and show that there was evidence of predation, that you were helping somebody. So if you're somebody who's using that equipment outside of the season, just be aware that you ought to have real evidence that something's going on, or you're at risk of having to go to court. And even if there is stuff going on, you still might have to go to court, because you might have to, just because you're not breaking the law doesn't mean you might not be cited, right? And then have to have the opportunity to show that you weren't doing something illegal. So I'm happy to stand up here and answer questions until you run out of them. We do have a podcast that comes out every couple of weeks that talks about this kind of stuff, pond management issues and that sort of thing. It's called Fins, Furs, and Feathers. It's everywhere where you look, but you could also scan that link and find it. That's my cell phone number. It's on the internet. I'm pretty available. You can call me, text me, whatever, if you got problems. I encourage you to reach out to your extension agent first, but if you can't get a hold of her, reach out to me. What questions do you